Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. What's happening, my Gravity peeps?
Hey.
You're back. We're back for another episode of the Gravity Commons Podcast. I'm joined by Christy and Ben once again. Hello.
Hey.
Hey, hey.
Once again, you got me thinking about how many episodes we've done.
It's dozens by
dozens.
Now.
Yep. There are dozens of us.
While you're looking, Ben, Christy.
I would love to hear you guys guess. What episode number do you think this is, this podcast that we're doing right now? What episode number is it?
Matt, you go first.
26. No, wait.
Dozens.
I'm going to say it's episode 222.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. I was going to say 211.
211?
211.
It is, yep. It is episode 387.
Come on! Are you serious?
I'm serious.
That's amazing.
That's a lot of episodes.
Is this?
It is.
Have we run out of things to say?
Well.
No.
People keep publishing books, so apparently not.
It only has spurred us on to talk more, I think.
So. It's been
been
fun.
That was a rhetorical question because I really have lots of things to say.
387. We release typically about one a week, so it's been 387 weeks, which has me thinking about that.
Divided by 52?
Yeah. It has me thinking about that. I guess what would that be divided by 52?
I can't do math.
Anyway, I recently read a book. Maybe I've talked about this on the podcast, but it's called 4,000 Weeks. It's basically about embracing the fact that your time is finite and life is finite, and you'll be happier if you just like forget the fantasy that you're going to like get everything done and that you are going to be so productive that all the things are going to get done. It's never going to happen. Just embrace the fact that you only have 4,000 weeks to do your life.
Okay.
It sounds crazy to me. That doesn't sound like that many weeks.
It doesn't.
Anyway.
But I did just divide 387 by 52.
And what'd you find?
And it's 7.44.
We're in the seven and a half year of our podcast then.
That's crazy.
That is crazy.
I will say some weeks we released double podcasts, but then sometimes we replayed podcasts. So maybe we have been doing this for 7 years.
Well, that's the calendar is right
here.
You know, we can just say the first three episodes were all released at the same time, March 14th, 2018.
By the way, that was BC. That was before Christy.
Before Christy.
That was
BC.
That was before COVID.
Yeah.
And before COVID.
Before COVID, before Christy. Yeah.
Gosh.
Anyway.
That was when we were wee babies.
Memory lane there, reminiscing.
Yeah. Hopefully, listener, you don't regret spending a part of your 4,000 weeks listening to that.
Yeah.
And this week is Holy Week, which is a big deal. If you celebrate the resurrection of Jesus, we've got four services this week. Is that right? Nope. Three.
Yeah, depends on how you count Easter. But Palm Sunday, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday is what we're doing.
Yeah.
We technically have a Compline service on Wednesday evening, too, so.
It's a full service.
Full
week.
Christy, what's your church doing for Holy Week?
Yeah, we have Palm Sunday. We have donkeys coming, we had donkeys coming. We're recording this before, but which is so fun. I preach on Sunday, and then on Wednesday we're doing middle school kids are doing a Passover Seder, kind of fun. And then Friday we have Good Friday service, and then Easter. No Maundy Thursday.
Yep.
Yeah, Ben and I were discussing, we typically don't wash people's feet at our church.
Mm-hmm.
We ask them to wash their feet before they come.
Yeah, it's in the bulletin every week. Please stop bringing your dirty feet to church.
But we were discussing why we don't, and what we could do as a cultural approximation of that ritualized act of service and how to parse that. Something I'm still noodling on.
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
During Ash Wednesday service at our church, we did stations, these different stations, and I helped co-lead this one station. It wasn't washing feet. It was actually blessing. Like, we took water and we like poured water on people's hands mm-hmm. and asked if we could like touch their hand. And then we held their hand and prayed for them. And wildly, it was seemed so personal and so meaningful, like lots of tears. And I think it was the touch and the prayer and the water and the blessing, all of it. It just was really beautiful. Mm. So it felt way better than ever having to wash somebody's feet.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
So.
Well.
Anyway.
Okay.
Speaking of meaningful.
Good transition.
Good, segue. Great segue. Great job, Matt Tebbe.
Mm. We're talking to Sheila Ray Gregoire today. She's one of the authors, along with her husband, Dr. Keith Gregoire, of their new book. They co-wrote it, The Marriage You Want, Moving Beyond Stereotypes for a Relationship Built on Scripture, New Data, and Emotional Health. Sheila is the face behind abaremarriage.com, as well as a sought-after speaker and an award-winning author of 9 books, including The Great Sex Rescue, which we talked about before with her on this podcast. Yes. And she deserves better. She's passionate about changing the evangelical conversation about sex and marriage to make it healthy, evidence-based, and biblical. Sheila and Keith live in Ontario, Canada together, near their 2 adult daughters and 3 grandbabies. And Sheila also knits.
Nice.
Really?
It's good to know.
I did not know that.
Bet you didn't know that. Even in line at the grocery store.
For real? She told you that?
Well, that's what her
You're making
says.
That up.
No, I'm not.
Oh, my goodness.
Let's hear from Sheila.
Let's see if this is true.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go.
Sheila Ray Gregoire, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks. It's good to be here again.
I should say welcome back. Sheila, I know you've shared a bit about yourself personally, but you seem to have found your niche in writing about men and women and sexuality and gender and relationships in the church. Can you talk a bit about how that became so important to you?
Yeah, so I shared this before in the podcast, but I'll do it super, super quick. But yeah. I was blogging about, you know, marriage, relationships, organizing, housework. I was the typical mommy blogger in 2008. The more I talked about sex, the more my traffic grew. So I became this Christian sex lady, which is weird. and I was doing that for years. But one thing I never did was read any other Christian books because I figured they love Jesus, I love Jesus. We're all saying the same thing. And then one day in February of 2019, I read the book Love and Respect. After witnessing a fight on Twitter. And I was like, this is a great way to procrastinate is to read a book. And it was like a nuclear bomb went off in my living room because it was so horrendous. And that thrust my team and I into a whole new endeavor where we just decided to start doing actual research and measuring how the stuff that we're teaching in evangelical circles is impacting people's marital and sexual satisfaction. And so our first big book was Great Sex Rescue. We've written She Deserves Better, Good Girl's Guide to Great Sex, Good Guy's Guide to Great Sex. But this one's different because what we're trying to do is say, okay, what if we don't have to tear down anymore? What if we can just build something healthy from the ground up? What would that look like?
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do here.
Yeah. So this is a reconstructing marriage book. And you already mentioned Love and Respect. Obviously, there's other ones. I remember you and I were kind of participating in a fairly famous, really bad marriage book that was written a couple of years ago, and it blew up all over social media. But maybe just by way of like framing this whole book, like could you give us like 1 or 2 or 3 like concrete marriage ideas that you are seeking to move us away from or out of or maybe the positive correlation into in this book?
One of the big problems with most evangelical marriage books is they are built on a faulty premise, and then all kinds of things flow from that faulty premise. And the faulty premise is this one, that men are meant to be an authority over women. And you start with that, And you know what? As soon as you have anyone in authority over anybody, you're going to see lots of negative outcomes. We found that in our survey. Multiple other surveys have found that. John Gottman, the world's premier marriage researcher, has found that. So that's a faulty premise. But when you have that premise, you need to then defend it. And so from that one premise flows all these negative things that we often hear in evangelical marriage books, like gender roles. Okay. So there has to be, if men are in authority of women, there has to be a reason. And the reason is men are like this, women are like this, and they don't understand each other. They're two completely alien species. And then that doesn't work. And so what is it that they tell people? Oh, your expectations are the problem. Okay. It's just that you're expecting too much. You need to go to God for your fulfillment and not to your spouse. So the reason you're miserable is that you're expecting too much. And that may work for a couple of years. And then when that still doesn't work, they say, well, marriage is hard. It's meant to make you holy, not happy. Don't you understand that marriage is hard, and marriage is the refining tool that God uses in your life to make you like Jesus, and so suffering is good. And when that still doesn't work and people are miserable, they come down with, you can't get divorced no matter what, and your reward is in heaven. And so just put up with this now, because isn't it wonderful how much reward you're going to get in heaven? And so this is what marriage books in the evangelical world have been built on, right? Gender roles, marriage is hard, don't expect too much, and remember, you can't divorce. Mm-hmm. That sounds awfully fun, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound just lovely? Isn't that what we all want? That would be a great sermon at a wedding.
I mean, it's not that marriage is easy, but what you're saying, Sheila, I think is really important, is that we have some really bad starting points, assumptions, presumptions that make marriage more difficult than it should be.
Exactly. And I like to say it this way: life is hard. Marriage brings a lot of complications to life. But marriage should be the thing that helps you handle the complications and the difficulties of life, not the thing that causes them.
Yes.
So,
gosh, I'm so glad that you wrote this book, and that, I just am really thankful for your research. I'm wondering, one specific thing is that, you know, you talk about the marriage triangle. God at the top, and then there's two people at the bottom. And many of us are familiar with another marriage illustration, which is one of these premises, right? The umbrella illustration of male husband covering. How does your image differ from the one, from the truth that you're trying to communicate with the triangle?
Yeah. So the umbrella analogy, for those who don't know, shows absolutely no idea or comprehension of how umbrellas work. Because you've got this umbrella at the top that's super big, that is supposed to be God. And then below that is the husband, and his umbrella is smaller. And somehow there's rain coming through from the, anyway. And then you have a wife with an even smaller umbrella, and then the children and the dog and the goldfish with smaller umbrellas after that, right? And so you have this series of umbrellas. And what we're saying is, no. It's not that women are under men. It's that we are both together under God. And when it functions like that, things work really well. Yeah. But what we're often told in the church is that instead of women going to God, women are supposed to go to their husbands, and the husbands go to God. So you kind of have this mediator, which is what the umbrella analogy does. And when couples do that, bad things happen. And that's what we measured. That's what we found. Partnership works super well. Teamwork works super well. Hierarchy does not.
Come on. I feel like I need to stand up and just start applauding. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you kind of lay this out with, I can see your little sign back there, Sheila, the bear marriage. And you aren't referring to like bear skin, but you're referring to an acronym, right? Mm-hmm. So bear then
is animal, bears.
No.
We should make sure.
B-A-R-E.
There you go. Bears. Yep.
Bear. Yeah, although I guess it could be a grizzly skin too, but bear. And it's an acronym. I wonder if you could tell us about the acronym and why that's important to you, how you came upon those four key concepts.
Yeah, so we rebranded our blog a couple of years ago. We were To Love, Honor, and Vacuum for the longest time, and then we rebranded into Bear Marriage because it just, To Love, Honor, Vacuum didn't fit with what we were talking about anymore. And bear is really nice because it has two connotations. One is about sex, which is what we primarily talked about. But the other is this stripping away of all of this ridiculous stuff that doesn't help and getting down to what God really wants. And so that's what we used when we wrote The Marriage You Want. Is bear is this idea of balance, where God is at the top, you know, and we are together as teammates. And what does that look like? Both as we're acting out marriage and as we're approaching the big things that are conflicts in our marriage, how can we make sure that we're balanced in how we do that? Then we have affection. You know, just simply liking being together. That's an important thing. Sex, that's an important thing. Responsibility. So how do we function as teammates? How do we divide up chores? How do we function as partners? And then when all of those things are working well, then you get what it is that we're really looking for when we get married, which is that emotional connection and emotional maturity and just emotional growth and feeling like we're one and that we're truly seen. And that's what we're looking for. We just want to be seen and known and still accepted and loved. Mm.
Mm. What do you think about that, Ben?
Sounds great. You have a way of very clearly saying things about marriage that it's like, oh yeah, that seems right. That's really good. Well, speaking of that acronym, Bear, your book that we're talking about today is organized into sections. You know, addressing each of those components. And I want to return to what you said earlier about, you know, marriage being about teamwork rather than hierarchy. And I wonder what you can share about what you've learned about teamwork in your marriage that you think is transferable maybe to other partnerships.
Yeah. So my husband and I, we've been married for about 33 years. We married very young and he was in med school. I took several graduate degrees while he was there. I put him through school. And over the course of our marriage, we functioned in different ways based on what the circumstances demanded. So when he was doing his residency in Toronto at the Hospital for Sick Children, he was working ridiculous hours. You know, he'd be 36 hours on, 12 hours off. When he was off, he really did need to sleep because he was up that entire 36 hours. And when he came home, I wasn't going to ask him to do housework. I just wanted him to play with the kids because they needed their dad. So I did basically everything else other than work. I did all the housework, the majority of the childcare, I did everything. But when he started his practice and he had a little bit more time, he started doing the finances. And now he actually does more housework than I do because he's cut back on his hours so much to help me with my job. So it's like, it's just about looking at what is working for us now. It's not about what should I do versus what should you do. It's what does the marriage need right now? And that's just a better way of seeing it. And that's what we're trying to do in this book is we're not going to give you pat answers. We're not going to say this is how you should work as a couple. We're saying, hey, this is what teamwork looks like. Now you figure out how it works in your own marriage because we're all different.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation. Let's get back to the show.
As you say that, you know, about housework and everything, like my wife and I renegotiated all of that when she went back to school a few years ago. One of the things that I realized in that renegotiation was that one thing I realized is that I hate doing bathrooms. So that's one thing. But my wife actually kind of likes it. So she does that. She hated cooking. She was kind of done with it after four kids. But I kind of like that. So we kind of switched those things up. But I guess one of the things that I noticed was that we would never espouse a hierarchical marriage. You know what I mean? Like we wouldn't have ever thought that was a good idea or thought that it was a good idea that that she should do most of the housework or be responsible for most of it. But we just one of the things we realized as we renegotiated was that we had just fallen into that pattern. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I had just fallen into the pattern that, oh, she's going to take care of that. If she needs some help, she'll let me know. That kind of a thing. And that's one of the things that we had to sort of rethink as we thought about this was like, oh, what, like, why that? Why do we assume in our marriage that we don't believe in hierarchy, but why did we assume that like Deb was going to take care of those things? And I, you know, I wouldn't need to think about them. So anyway, so that was a helpful, I think, lesson for us as well. It's like, even if you don't think your marriage is hierarchical, you inherit, we found anyway, that we inherited a lot of assumptions that probably came from that world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, your book talks about this too, the traditional gender roles, like biblical manhood and biblical womanhood. It sounds like that's what you're naming, Ben. And Sheila, I wonder if you could speak to what do we do with gender as Christians? How do we navigate, quote, roles? Yeah. And is it even helpful to think about that, like that?
I don't think it really is. And the data shows it doesn't work. So there is, let's say that she is a stay-at-home mom and does the majority of the housework and he works outside the home. Mm-hmm. There is nothing wrong with that. Okay. We didn't find any downside to that in the data. Unless, and this is a big unless they think that this is what God ordained. And as soon as you think, no, this is what we're supposed to do because it's from God, then you start to see negative results. You start to see decreased intimacy. You start to see people who just don't feel as close, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like, if it's a choice, it's fine. But as soon as we do it because we're trying to fit ourselves in boxes, then how can you be truly known if you're not really being you?
Yeah.
And that's why I think we really need to get away from gender roles, and we really need to stop thinking about, okay, how can I be a biblical woman and how can I be a biblical man, and just ask, how can I be a Christian in my marriage? Besides, if you're going to be a biblical woman, which biblical woman are you going to be? Are you going to be Jael, who puts a tent peg through Sisera's head? Are you going to be Deborah, who leads an army? Are you going to be Priscilla, who teaches men? Are you going to be Phoebe, who is sent to lead the church in Rome? Like, which biblical woman exactly are we aiming to be? You know, it makes no sense. Yeah. Mm.
Well, okay, sex and marriage, you've written extensively about this elsewhere, mm-hmm. and it seems to come up as a source of conflict, disconnect in many marriages. What can you share with us about how to navigate this aspect of our marital union?
Yeah. So here's the biggest piece of advice I can give people is stop prioritizing sex and start prioritizing the ingredients of great sex. Because what we tend to do is we judge our sex life on how many times we're having sex a week or a month, as opposed to saying, what is that sex like? Because when you read the majority of Christian marriage books and they're talking about sex, they will identify the big, big problem in couple sex lives. And it is, go ahead, tell me, what is the big problem?
Doesn't happen enough.
Yeah. And why doesn't it happen?
Because you have 14 kids and you can't keep them out of your room.
Maybe that's not in there.
Is that not in there?
Yeah.
Because one partner doesn't want to.
Well, right? Which partner?
And it's the woman, right?
It's the woman, right?
Partner. Yes.
Yeah. And that's why the vast majority of books are all assuming that he wants it like he's a rabid dog and she doesn't. And so we need to figure out how to get her to want it more. So here's what we did. We looked at the women in our survey who said that they had very low sexual desire. Okay. So they never really want sex. And then we asked three simple questions. Do you orgasm when you have sex? Do you have sexual pain? And do you feel emotionally close to your husband? And when we took out the women who had sexual pain, who didn't orgasm or who don't feel close during sex, we have now explained 85% of women's low libido. And I'm sure if we had also asked, hey, does he watch porn or, you know, any of those things, we probably could have explained the rest of it. Are you exhausted? Do you do the majority of the housework? Like, if she doesn't want sex, there is a reason. And instead of just lecturing her on how she has to have sex more, why don't we figure out why isn't sex good for her? Because, you know, women tend to want to do things that are good and fun and that benefit them. So if women aren't wanting to do something, maybe that's a sign that we should be getting curious instead of a sign that we should just be getting judgmental and blaming.
Yeah. I really like... I did get to be a part of that, by the way. Like, I got to answer all those questions, which was so fun, which is why I was so excited to be a part of this interview, because I was like, hey, I'm in there. I'm all the good answers, by the way. Just
you're
so
part
you
of the you're part of the data. Yeah. What you're saying,
you're part of the data.
Yeah, I'm part of the data.
And it was a long survey. I think it was our longest one yet. Yeah, it was a long one.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just want to punctuate what you just said, Sheila, and maybe press in a little more around it. Like, a lot of couples get hyper focused or even make a fetish of sex. Like, we got to fix this sex thing. And what you're saying is, taking sort of pain and a lack of an orgasm off the table. If we And sometimes those are the ingredients. Like, we have to deal with men who think that female orgasm is a myth, or females who do have like pain in having sex. But we also what I want to hold out, maybe that was important to me, is like the ingredients of sexual desire include emotional intimacy and connection. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how do we foment that? I wonder if you could talk about this, because you do talk about skills we need to build intimacy. Later in your book, I wonder if you could pretend like we don't know how to do that. Mm-hmm. Like, what would be the ways we would move towards our partner to create and build better intimacy?
Yeah, of course. One of the issues I have is intimacy can mean so many different things, and emotional intimacy definitely does lead to sexual desire, but there also is elements, like, you can have really good emotional intimacy, but then still mess up physical intimacy because of some of the ways that we approach sex or our attitudes towards sex. You know, like Emerson Eggerich telling women that, hey, if he vacuums, or telling men that if you vacuum, she'll get turned on. It's like, no, vacuuming doesn't turn anyone on. Like, or if it does, that's a problem. Like, you should probably get therapy for that. Like, like, no.
This is a no kink shaming podcast, Sheila. So, just want to say,
like helping with housework is great, but it doesn't get someone physically aroused. And I just some of the idiotic things that people say. And when we think of sex as something which is transactional, you know, even if you're good friends outside the bedroom, we can still say, well, I mean, I did the dishes, so you shouldn't be as tired, so we should have sex. It's like, no, we have to get away from this transactional view of sex and understand that sex is the expression of who we are together. It's not just this thing that our bodies do. And when you've grown up with kind of a transactional view of sex or a pornographic view of sex, a lot of those things are really difficult. And we see a lot of couples who actually do have fairly good emotional intimacy outside the bedroom, but then when it comes to the bedroom, it's like everything changes because of what they've been taught about sex. Yeah. So yes, emotional intimacy really does feed desire, but we also do need to deal with a lot of the crappy teachings we've had about sex and a lot of the ways that we have compartmentalized it in our lives to make it mean something else.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, just talking together and growing the ability to be vulnerable, and this is scary for a lot of people, and especially a lot of men, not only men, but in our culture, women are often acculturated to be able to talk about their emotions more so than men are. This does not mean that women are biologically more able to talk about their emotions. And it doesn't mean that women necessarily will do better than men at this, any individual woman. But in our culture in general, women are more accustomed to emotional language than men are. And so what can happen is that men especially can kind of channel their emotional needs for connection into sex. So because I am not comfortable sharing my emotions, because I am not comfortable being super emotionally vulnerable, I'll have sex to feel close. And when you do that, sex can actually make you feel more distant, because it's like, you only want my body, you don't actually want to know me. So the more that we can become emotionally vulnerable, the more libido grows, the more desire grows, the better sex is, et cetera.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about my life personally, and my life as a Christian man. And Sheila, I don't know if your research touches on this at all, but I wouldn't be surprised if there are a large number of Christian men who don't know what emotional vulnerability is or how to do it.
Yeah.
Like, they're cut off from their interior world.
Yeah.
I heard somebody quip once, I think it was Brené Brown, who said that most men can only feel five emotions. And she said it's angry, happy, hungry, horny, and tired.
Yes.
And she said three of those aren't even emotions.
Yes.
And so I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit. Like, if we actually want to explore and learn how to be emotionally vulnerable, where would we start?
Yeah, we have a lot about this in chapter 8 of The Marriage You Want, where we talk about understanding your story, getting accustomed to telling your backstory to your spouse. A lot of us don't know how to do that, you know? Mm. Like, hey, when was the first time that you remember crying? Or when you were in eighth grade, who did you just hate and why? If you could go back in time and introduce me to someone I never got the chance to meet from your childhood, who would it be and why? Like, you know, talking about these little things that can help open up our world into our spouse's world. But there's an exercise that I think is a great one to learn about your emotional health or your emotional world. And it's just sharing the time in the day that you felt the most in the groove today. Like, I am doing what the Holy Spirit put me on earth to do. I am rocking this. And the time that you felt the most defeated. Like, I never want to do this again. I hate this. This is awful. Because when you see each other at the end of the day, what do we normally say? Right? We say, oh, how was your day? Or what did you do today? And how do you answer that? Well, I had 6 client meetings. I went to the gym at lunch. I tried to get in my 10,000 steps. Like, you know, like that doesn't really let you in emotionally. But if you say, okay, what was the time you felt the most in the groove? And what was the time you felt the most defeated? That opens up your emotional world to your spouse, but it also opens it up to you, because a lot of us aren't used to thinking about that. And if you have to voice it, you start to realize, oh, I really didn't like that. I didn't like that today. Yeah. And then you can say, well, what didn't you like? You know, what made you feel defeated in there? Do you remember feeling defeated like that at any other time? And when my husband and I started doing this, because he was working not in our hometown, there was a couple of years where he was commuting a lot, and sometimes we didn't see each other. So we would do this by phone. And I realized the moment that I felt the most defeated was the same every single day. And it was when I looked at my inbox. And so I hired someone to start going through my inbox, and it was great. It was like, oh, wow, this is awesome. My life's so much better. So sometimes you learn a lot about yourself too.
Yeah. Well, the acknowledgement, the noticing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you notice it and then they start to notice it too. I've found, even with my husband, sometimes we'll be in a conversation and I notice I'm about to share something really vulnerable, but it may be something really, he might think it's kind of simple or silly, or like, he might not notice how vulnerable I feel like this thing I'm about to share is, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've now started to say, hey, babe, I want to share something really vulnerable, or this feels really important and really a part of my heart. I want you to know, almost like I'm like putting a whistle, like, hey, pay attention. This is something, because it's me noticing it, but it's also him noticing it too, and vice versa, you know? Mm-hmm. Which may sound kind of, my kids actually just recently heard me say that to him, and they're like, are you telling him to pay attention to your vulnerability? I'm like, yes, I am. Because I think sometimes we need help.
This has been one of the more painful parts of my marriage. It's where I or my wife, Sharon's her name, will share something that's vulnerable, and the other person won't clue into that. Mm-hmm. And so we don't actually treat the vulnerability with the necessary sensitivity and honor and tenderness.
Right.
And so we'll either make a joke or just jump to solution-based whatever, or change the subject. And it's experienced then as a rejection of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So kind of what you were describing, Christy, sort of on the flip side is, I've had to say, hey, this is really hard for me to talk about. Here's what I need from you as I share.
Yeah.
You know, just to clue the partner into, like, you know, I need you to care for me here.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know. Nobody ever taught me how to do that.
No, most of us grow up and we don't learn this stuff. And when people run away from vulnerability, it does affect your marriage long term. Mm. Because you can have a relationship with a coworker where you never get that vulnerable. Maybe, you know, you share a lot of facts about your life. You talk all the time. You laugh. You bring each other's coffees. Maybe they know what your opinions are about politics or football or whatever, but they don't actually know how you're feeling. But you feel really close to them. Because with a coworker, you're not expected to be vulnerable. But if you have that same level of communication with your spouse, where, yeah, we know each other's opinions on everything, but we don't actually know anything vulnerable, you're going to feel distant. Because with your spouse, you're supposed to be close. Yeah. This is the one person you're supposed to be able to share yourself with. Mm-hmm. And so even if it's difficult, you know, going deeper and letting your spouse go deeper is so important. And, you know, that, I think this is one of the biggest gifts we can give each other. Because so many people don't know how they're feeling. They don't know how to express emotion. So if we can learn how to listen and ask interesting and probing questions, we can actually help our spouse discover a lot of, about themselves too.
And now, a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Yeah, I wonder, Sheila, if you can share, you know, I'm hearing you name that as kind of a skill, you know, that we can develop in our marriages, you know, to kind of build that intimacy, which is, you know, the bigger issue that we've been talking about besides just, you know, trying to solve sex as a problem isolated from other aspects, you know, of a marriage is a fool's errand. But I wonder if you could share some of the other skills that we need to build intimacy that will, you know, sustain and help to kind of grow our marriages. Are there other skills that you can share with us that will help?
Yeah, well, let me tell you about the marriage hierarchy of needs, because I think this is a really important concept for couples to understand. So let me tell you an example first. And this will be, we call them Gabriella and Brad in chapter 2. So they've been married 10 years. Three little kids. Gabriella works as a nurse. She does a lot of shift work. She's often exhausted. She's always trying to find, you know, juggling babysitters, et cetera. And she does the majority of the housework. And 6 months ago, Brad confessed that he's been using porn their whole marriage. And so their sex life, which was on life support before, has just fallen off a cliff. And they're just not having sex anymore. And she feels betrayed. He's not really doing anything to show her that he's quitting or trying to grow intimacy. He's just mad at her. So one day in frustration, Brad insists that they go talk to the pastor. And so Gabriella and Brad go into the pastor's office and explain what's going on. And the pastor says to Gabriella, well, you can't just cut him off of sex. How about if we just try to meet each other's needs? So it sounds like what Brad really needs is for you to be more sexually available to him. And it sounds like what you really need is for Brad to be more available to you to help with the children. So how about if Brad does some concrete things, like he takes on bath time and he takes on homework time, and then you have more sex? And that sounds like the way we tend to handle marriage problems. We're going to find a compromise where we each get our needs met, right? This is kind of the way that love and respect is set up, or the five love languages. It's all very transactional. Here's the problem, okay? Compromise only works if you start on an even playing field. And Brad and Gabriella were not on an even playing field. If one person is giving, you know, is fulfilling 90% of what that household needs, and one person is fulfilling 10, and you ask both of them to put in another 10 units, you haven't fixed anything. Mm-hmm. And in that marriage, you know, Gabriella was barely surviving. She wasn't sleeping much. She was trying to keep the household together. She was looking after the kids. Plus, she's dealing with all this betrayal. Mm-hmm. And what's Brad doing? He's just mad because he's not getting sex. And he's not really helping enough. And so, you know, Maslow came up with this idea of this hierarchy of needs, where it's a pyramid. And at the bottom of that pyramid are the needs, the fundamental needs we all have, like food, shelter, water, air, you know, safety. And then you get into things that make life better, you know, friendship, fun, et cetera. And then at the top, you have the self-actualization, feeling like I'm called, feeling like I'm really living out my purpose. And a marriage functions in the same way too, which is we have the things at the bottom, which just need to get done. The rent needs to be paid. The kids need their homework done. We need to get the laundry done. You know, the kids need to get out the door to go to school. We need food made. So that's like your surviving tier. And then you get into your living tier where, okay, I'm actually at a job that I like. we're working on our friendship. We're trying to find a church we like. Like we're trying to make our life better. And then you have the thriving where it's like, yes, I'm in a calling. Like I feel like I'm meeting my calling from God. We're thriving as a couple, et cetera. And what often happens is one person is in the surviving tier. And one person is up here living a pretty good life, just wanting it to be better. And it's like that compromise doesn't work when you're on different tiers. The solution is for both of you to get in the trenches and lift and put in your all so that you can maybe lift up out of that surviving tier and get into the living tier. And that's what Brad and Gabriella didn't understand. And that's a skill that I think a lot of us don't get, is that in many couples, one person is barely surviving. They are holding everything together. And one person is just trying to fulfill their calling. You see this a lot in ministry couples, you know, where someone is pursuing their calling from God, but in so doing, they are forcing their spouse down to the barely surviving tier to support their calling. And that is not going to work in the long run if you want to flourish in your marriage.
Sheila, I'm just thinking of the incredible help, the sort of just being able to have that conversation between two people who are like locked in a relationship that's not quite working and nobody knows why, you know, and each person has like a list of resentments or reasons that the other person is failing them. Like being able to have that shared lexicon and come to some kind of mutual advocacy for like moving up out of just getting surviving. You know, it's such a gift. And so really, there's so much else you cover in this book. We can't get to it all today, but I just want to thank you for writing it. And maybe you can close us out with, you know, what do you hope this book does? Like, what do you, if you hear stories about that this book has had an impact, like what kind of stories would fill your heart with appreciation and gladness?
Well, what we're hearing right now from our launch team is just that this has given people words to what they've been experiencing. And that's been so helpful. We like to say that we didn't write this book to get people to stay in a marriage they hate. We're trying to help people create a marriage they love. And I think that's very possible. We've seen it. The data shows that it is possible. We just need to understand these dynamics in a better way. On a totally other note, I think one of the reasons or one of the dreams that I have for this book is that it will replace all the crappy marriage books that are out there in the Christian world, because we have an awful lot of them. And if you look at our best-selling Christian marriage books, the majority of them were written 20 years ago or more.
Yeah.
So we haven't had new Christian marriage books, and they all say the same thing. They all say men are like this, women are like this. Women, you need to have more sex. Men, you need to talk more because your wife just wants you to talk. Like they all say exactly the same thing, and they don't really get to the heart of what affects marriages today. You know, the imbalance of housework and mental load, that's huge. Nobody talks about it. Most of these books were even written before the porn apocalypse. Like, we need to get a healthy book out there. And so that's what I'm really praying for. There's a study guide that goes along with it so that people can use it for premarital counseling. There's small group material. There's so much. And so our prayer is just that, let's get rid of the crappy stuff that's been hurting marriages, and let's get something that's actually evidence-based. Wow, because you can do that in the church and not be an apostate or something. So.
Yes.
Yes.
The title of the book, again, is The Marriage You Want, Moving Beyond Stereotypes for a Relationship Built on Scripture, New Data, and Emotional Health. Sheila, thanks so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a question that didn't get answered in that interview. And
let's get Sheila back here.
I know, right? I want to know, like, you know, she talked about the hierarchy of marriage and needs and that type of thing. But that would require a couple to be able to negotiate. And I wonder if that is, like, one of the skills that really needs to be practiced, modeled, taught, because I don't think couples know how to negotiate.
Yeah.
Do you think that's fair?
I think that's fair. Maybe one of the things I would add to it is, you know, there is such a thing as like business negotiations, right? And I think that if couples know how to negotiate, I think that's the kind of negotiation that they're accustomed to, which is a lot like you know, she said that pastor's advice.
Right. I do this, you do that. Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is like, I have these needs and you're contractually obligated to meet them. You have needs that I'm contractually obligated to meet. Mm. So let's negotiate on who, you know, where I think what you're talking about though is more of a willingness to sort of listen.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's a difference between the transactional nature and like skills that actually cultivate intimacy, vulnerability, a closeness, a sense that we're on the same team here, you know?
Right. Like an emotionally healthy negotiation.
Yeah. So negotiation sometimes can be like mutually assured non-destruction. You know, like the Cold War was a negotiation.
Yeah. I don't mean that.
Yeah. But I'm just saying like sometimes negotiating means I get what I want in this place. You get what you want in this place. But there isn't any more intimacy because we've just had concessions. Mm.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Or, I need a different
or arrangements.
Word. Right.
Yeah.
You know? But I think on the other side of that, Christy, is that like, I know in many of my friends' marriages and just conversations with them throughout the years, they've expressed, you know, I feel like I accommodate all the time. I feel like I'm always the one giving, but like my needs aren't listened to or aren't met or aren't honored. Mm-hmm. And they feel stuck. It's like, well, I can keep giving, I can keep doing this, but there doesn't seem to be any reciprocal mutuality here. Like there doesn't seem to be any, it's like it's an asymmetrical kind of concession, right. You know? And I think that there some people are stuck because of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you know, what I think you're probably talking about, Christy, is just like in, you know, that situation you talked about, Matt, where one partner is, you know, sort of feeling like, hey, if I just give and sacrifice long enough, eventually this will work, or eventually my partner will listen to me or reciprocate, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas like what's needed in that situation might be, you know, just the risk of being honest about how you're experiencing your marriage, you know, to be able to kind of talk to your partner and say, hey, this is the story I tell myself about our marriage, and it's building resentment and bitterness in me. And I don't want that. I want closeness with you. But I don't know how to tell a different story about what's going on. And I wonder if we can talk about that, you know?
Hmm. But yeah.
But then that, you know, that takes, it does always take two to tango. You know what I mean? Like that's been, for me anyway, one of the, it feels risky. I like things in my life to be like able, I'd like to be able to control things, I like to be able to kind of do something about my life. And, you know, the really risky thing about marriage is like, well, I can't engineer this. This is
right.
This is a partnership. This is a person, you know?
Right.
And I can't, all I can do is be vulnerable as, you know, as much as best I can, you know, and go from there. But I can't engineer certain outcomes. I can't manipulate or control, you know, my wife's behavior.
Right.
I mean, I can try to, but it doesn't build intimacy, and it most of the time doesn't work anyway. So, right. anyway,
one of the ways I like to build intimacy with Sharon is I like to do pranks.
Please, that cannot build intimacy.
Oh, she loves
Does
it.
Does she love it?
Yeah. So, no, like, for
Cece
instance,
Cece loves it. Cece, I can see that. She loves it. Does Sharon really love it?
I haven't written The Marriage You Want. I haven't written that book. And I'm not sure if Sharon wrote the book, this would go in there. But like, for instance, this week I changed the labels on all of the spices in my wife's spice rack.
And are you for real?
You know what? I'm not in trouble yet, but the time is cumin.
Oh my gosh. You totally had me. You totally, up until right at the end, I'm like, oh shoot, Christy, he's about to just.
I feel like I want to have a secret signal
sign.
For you.
Yeah, like itch your nose or something, so I can as soon see as he it. Said I'm so pranks, gullible.
I was like, yeah, I was like,
this I was like, I know Sharon. She Cece likes pranks. Go jump you out of her.
It's so funny because Ben is like, Ben has been so berated with my humor.
It's true. It's a big part of my life.
It's been sort of like a prolonged water torture that he
it's a good metaphor.
His spirit is so sensitive now to it by means of like self-preservation and protection. Yes,
trauma.
That he's like, here it comes. He's going to be full of crap for the next 30 seconds to 30 minutes. So just endure.
Yep.
Oh, man. Well, there you have it, folks.
Yep. You got to gird yourself for the dad jokes. So.
I'm going to try these questions tonight. What were
the questions again?
What was the time you felt most in the groove today? And when did you feel the most defeated?
I also like, she asked, like, when did you first cry? When do you remember first crying? Ooh. That's a really good, and you know,
get to know you question.
Yes, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah.
You know, I'm struck by in the groove.
You know what I'd say to my wife if she asked me that? I'd say, the first time you said no when I asked you if we could have sex.
Speaking of manipulative behavior.
I think that's what I learned from Sheila. I think Sheila taught me.
Yeah, that's what she taught me.
I'm kidding.
No, I am struck by those questions. When did you feel most in the groove and when did you feel defeated? Those are very similar to the Ignatian questions of consolation and desolation.
Yes.
So it's almost like a way of doing an examine, I don't know how to pronounce that word, like with your spouse at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Rather than how was your day or how are you, which I always answer, I immediately go through like, well, I started the day by doing this and then I did this. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, halfway through my answer, I'm like, I'm not answering the question actually. Yes. But yeah, those are great questions. It's almost like doing a little spiritual review of your day, spiritual emotional review. I like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm writing this down on my little note app and listener.
I'm going to circle back around and ask you how it went. I guess, can I do that? Can I ask you guys how it went?
Yeah.
I'll do it too.
Yeah. Can.
Okay.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'd love that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to see if my wife wants to read this book with me, too.
Okay.
It's good.
Maybe I'll just read it to her while she sleeps.
It'll subliminally get in there. Yeah, I think that's how reading works.
All right.
Everybody, she could read it. You rub her feet.
You know,
I mean,
that would go better than, wait, she reads it and I rub her feet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does she read it out loud?
I offer to give her foot rubs all the time.
Look at you. Gold star. Mm.
All the time. Gold star. And she usually takes me up on it.
All right. Yeah, there you go, listener. Ask questions, read the book, do foot rub.
All right. We'll report back.
All right.
All right.
All right.
Peace. See you, buddy.
Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.